You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is James Tracy. Mr. Tracy, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Dave.
Can I call you Jim?
That's fine.
All right, great. Jim, you've been in the news a lot lately, and I guess it all started with Sandy Hook when you commented on the event. And I believe this was about a week after it occurred. I was reading something that said December 20th. Is that correct? Would that date be correct, Jim?
Yeah, the first article came out on the 20th of December. That's right.
Okay. I want to get into this in great detail in a moment. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are?
Yeah, I am, for the most part, a professionally trained academic, and I teach at a moderately sized university in Southeast Florida. I received my PhD in communication from University of Iowa in 2002, and my master's in media studies from University of Arizona in 1998, and my undergrad from Cal State, from San Jose State University. And so really, almost the past 20 years, I've been involved in academic work. And so the things that I do, which are, I guess, technically on the side, as far as media criticism and commentary and the like, are really kind of integrated into what I do professionally, much to the chagrin, I think, of probably my employer. it's difficult to get around, and I wouldn't be involved in studying the media and commenting on it and critiquing it if I were not able to talk about the political element of it, because all media, especially news media, goes without saying, are political by their very nature. So that was something that I had to deal with throughout 2013 because of the controversy in the media concerning my remarks about Sandy Hook. And it primarily had to do with the fact that, hey, here's someone who is credentialed. Here's someone who might be taken seriously, you know, someone who really is part of the establishment, because I think that those of us in academe more or less are. And so if you do speak out about something such as Sandy Hook or the Boston bombing or 9/11, it's something that is, I think, taken quite seriously, both by those inside and outside of the profession. There's kind of this weird sensorial dynamic that goes on that's sort of difficult to explain. But nevertheless, it's something that I encountered really full bore in 2013 when my remarks were highlighted by the media over the course of a couple of weeks' time. And what was kind of disappointing about that was that my colleagues and superiors really didn't want to talk about the issue that I was bringing up. It wasn't a matter of, hey, wow, maybe you have something here. Let's discuss it. After all, we're supposed to be, you know, we're supposed to be intellectuals and we're supposed to be sophisticated and let's talk about it. No, it was like, we do not want this controversy blemishing the trademark of the place that we manage and the place that we're a part of. I even had three colleagues write a letter to the local regional newspapers here asking for me to resign after I remarked on the Boston Marathon bombing, which was really taken aback and still am. It's not a matter of, I think I was shocked at the time, but now it's just really more so kind of disappointment. Like, we're just things we can't talk about. We talk about a whole host of issues. And not only that, but academics are among the few individuals, among the few, it's really probably the only profession that has job security in the way of tenure. So we're supposed to be able to talk about these things. And yet there's this, again, this odd dynamic involving censorship that takes place where that it can't, these things can't be brought up. And I think 9/11 is probably the best example. And but Oklahoma City or even the JFK assassination, the article that appeared in the Sun Sentinel here in South Florida on January 7th of 2013, that really sparked the whole media firestorm, ended with the paragraph that I also had second thoughts or misgivings about the official narratives of JFK, Oklahoma City, 9/11. And, well, who in their right mind wouldn't if you actually looked closely or just semi-closely at those events? It almost goes without saying. I mean, I don't consider myself to be an amateur. I'm trained and in media studies and the political components of that. So those types of events are really, you know, low. They're low hanging fruit when we consider types of political intrigue. So that's a brief overview. I never quite thought, I never anticipated that I would be at the center of that sort of controversy. And, you know, I had some colleagues come to me and say, wow, you know, you've got enough to write about for the rest of your life. I'm envious. And we're at least partially supportive of the of everything, but it also was a learning experience because I was right in the crossfire of the type of thing that I typically look into and teach as well, research and teach. So it was a real experiential learning environment, I guess.
Right, when art becomes life.
Yes, exactly.
It's nuts. It really is. I'll tell you, it doesn't surprise me. I know you said that it was on the 20th, but when did you actually think that something might be wrong with the official narrative? And what was it that made you think that?
When I began looking more closely at the event, and initially it was the alleged additional shooters that may have been on the, you know, on the scene. And I think this was something that was also being considered by other researchers online. So to some degree, it was simply a matter of tapping into what their observations were and writing about it. There were people in the alternative media, I think fairly prominent people as well, who were already commenting on this to a certain degree, and they were not taken to task, at least to the degree that I was. So I think that as I looked more so into it, I became somewhat obsessed. Actually, my dissertation work involved the framing of a political figure, and it was really a conspiracy that took place, and it was a very fascinating thing to unearth and to delve into. And this sort of rekindled that curiosity, what really took place there. And I think that I really did have an epiphany when I sat down and began to transcribe the press conference of H. Wayne Carver. And that was for an article that I published on the 24th of December, so Christmas Eve day. Mm-hmm. And as I was taking down his words, going back on the YouTube and going back and trying to get every word correct and trying to make out the questions of reporters, because they were they were quite faint. And it occurred to me that this man I hate to say it, but I'm not sure if he really knows quite what he's talking about. He doesn't seem to be very well informed for someone who had presided over this extensive number of autopsies. Now, granted, it must have been, you know, in the event that it took place as we have been told that it took, how it took place, it must have been a traumatic experience. But nevertheless, here's someone who is very experienced, who's the top top coroner in the state of Connecticut. He's there for a reason. And that's something I attempted to point out in that article, Unanswered Questions, about this guy. It's not as if he is put off very much by death and gore. It's part of what he has been doing for quite some time. And yet he's really befuddled in terms of how to address what he had presided over. So that's really what more or less clinched it for me. And then as I began looking closer, the overall aura of the event, particularly with the interviews with families, parents and family members, on the whole, they just seemed somewhat feigned. And so, it's not a matter of one particular thing. That was the initial thing, the Carver interview. And it was, you know, it's interesting to see he's not been interviewed by the press once. Since December 15th, you know, the day after the event, which is really unusual. I mean, here's someone you would think would be making the talk show rounds, would have a book out. And you could say that, I think, about a number of the individuals involved in the event itself. He's just fallen out of public view. And so that's unusual. But his initial performance, if you will, was rather odd. And so that I think, whetted my appetite, and I continued to delve more into the what we are told took place. And of course, my overall thesis is that the event has not been reported to us in the way in which it took place. And I think that there was one piece that I wrote that I delved further into this, saying that, I mean, looking at the interviews, it looks as if this could have been a staged event. Perhaps there were crisis actors involved. Now, I did not say there were crisis actors involved with Sandy Hook. And that's, you know, that's of course what was taken out of context and so forth. But what I was saying was that, you know, DHS does contract with this group called the Crisis Actors in Colorado. So they're on record. They're involved in doing this stuff. And so maybe this is something that we should consider. But I think that what the major media sought to do was to take various statements out of context and then just, you know, contend that I was making these really wild allegations, and there was much more to it than that. And that was another interesting and really instructive lesson, in that the traffic to my website, for example, was quite considerable after the story broke. But that's dwarfed by the number of people, I'm sure, who were out there who saw, you know, Anderson Cooper discussing me for a couple of nights on CNN or other venues, where someone really takes what is stated in a headline or in a soundbite and runs with it, versus actually delving more so into what I had actually written and remarked on.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it is that the mainstream media adopted the position that somebody like you should be avoided at all costs?
I'm inclined to think that they really don't want for the general public to consider any sort of alternative narratives or interpretations of public events, of important events, such as Sandy Hook or 9/11 or what have you. And the idea that an academic is falling into the fray of conspiracy theorists is even more alarming. I think overall it was an attempt to have me dismissed from my position. That's one way that they can go after you is if you have a position such as what I'm in, then they can go after your employment. And that's been done with other individuals, academics and so forth.
Sure,
and journalists as well.
Why would they want to do that to begin with? Versus, let's say, that was Jim Tracy, and he just told us what he thinks. What do you think? Do you agree with Mr. Tracy, or do you disagree with him? Why couldn't they just say that?
That's a good question. I think that the approach that CNN in particular took was so heavy-handed that a lot of people who in fact contacted me and told me this, they began questioning the event after after those broadcasts. That wow, I mean, how I've never seen Anderson Cooper so upset.
You know? Right.
that he could. So I think in a way it kind of backfired on them. But the media have been involved in calling into question, in defaming, in derogating public figures for a long time. This is something that can be traced to the 1960s, this took place with, for example, Jim Garrison, who was a public figure, of course, who was delving into the JFK assassination. But he was also someone who was credentialed, and he had the power to subpoena witnesses, to subpoena evidence, and potentially to bring the CIA out onto the carpet. And so there was a campaign that was waged to discredit him. We know this now through declassified documents. And I think that's something that was on my mind as well. And it was really rather unnerving when this was taking place with CNN, because, of course, Anderson Cooper has ties to the CIA. He worked for them after his years at Yale, infiltrating student groups in Burma, for example. Once in the CIA, always in the CIA in some way, shape, or form. So that was a bit disconcerting for me anyway. And then who's to say actually to what degree this was coordinated, because I just received a flurry of emails and even phone calls as well, but primarily emails. Most of them, really vitriolic about how could you say this about the kids, and all of this really, all of these, this wave of just, hate and indignation really crested around the time of the those broadcasts by CNN.
Mm-hmm. What's the motivation for CNN to do this to you? That's what I can't figure out.
Well, they did have a stake in terms of presenting Sandy Hook. They were there on the ground. They presented, live coverage of the events, and a good deal of their coverage is really quite questionable in terms of the interviews with the apparent victims, and actually also some of the coverage they were showing of the alleged, SWAT teams arriving at Sandy Hook were not even of that school. In one sequence, it was the Catholic school in town, St. Rose of Lima, I believe, and a drill that was taking place there.
Right.
And so I don't think that these things happen in error. Now, granted, there is the haste and of the given moments where some things might not be reported quite correctly, but there were just so many errors as well throughout the coverage. Wondering to what degree those are by design, and to what degree they are in fact genuine. It's difficult for us to tell. I mean, the media are in some ways as impenetrable as the intelligence agencies and
Right. Other
agencies in our government. You know, we just we'll never really know what happens in the upper echelons. And even the reporters won't. I think that some of the reporters, for example, who were questioning Carver, were really, you know, their radar was going up as well. And I'm led to conclude they were just kind of called off, you know, because he contradicted himself a number of times and was just appeared to be terribly poorly prepared, to put it lightly.
Yeah, I did watch his entire presentation. I know he did say in his presentation that this was only the second time that he ever participated in a news conference. Did you hear that as well, since you did the transcript? Or am I wrong?
I believe that he did say that, which doesn't make an awful lot of sense. I think the overall news conference was about 15 minutes or so, and I think I transcribed about 13 minutes of that, because some of it was just sort of back and forth that I didn't think was quite as pertinent. So it might have been in that passage where he said that, but that would seem really very unusual if that in fact were the case, given that he is the chief coroner and he's in charge of, you know, an entire office that that does this type of work.
Right. And finally, on the media, Jim, do you think it's just about the haste and the ratings, or do you think there's something more with Sandy Hook?
I believe that there is something more. I think that these events are done in part with the coordination of the media. And that's not to say that all of the media, but it is to say particular venues and the more, you know, prominent venues such as a CNN or other cable news network. And as well as the print news media to a significant degree. So, for example, one of the papers that really played a very instrumental role in Sandy Hook was the Hartford Courant, which is a Tribune Company paper, owned by Tribune Company. Also, Tribune Company owns the Sun Sentinel, which is the paper that came out and attacked me on January 7th. Because I think that I'm quite certain that the Courant and Tribune realized that my pieces, as well as other writers' work on Sandy Hook at that time between the events and the early part of January, were generating an awful lot of buzz and traffic because I was linking right to their site for various articles and things that they had put up their reportage on the event. I think that, again, overall, I'm inclined to believe that there are that the media, certain elements of the media, are involved in presenting these events. They have to be.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's a cover-up of some kind?
Well, a cover-up suggests that the event took place as we have been told, and that there have been deaths and so forth. There's no doubt the fact that these drills are conducted in very lifelike fashion, and the media are also involved in the presentation of these events. So I think that with a certain degree of coordination between the government and the media, of course, you know, this also goes into the whole matter of media conglomeration and the concentration of ownership. Something like this is much easier to pull off than it would have probably been 30 years ago, when you had a greater plurality of ownership. And there's also the whole technological element of it as well. But I'm inclined to think, again, that this is something that likely could be orchestrated and presented in a fashion that appears to be lifelike and realistic and yet that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think one of the purposes could be for that?
Well, I think with Sandy Hook, it is gun control, is challenging Second Amendment rights. The Obama administration and his allies in Congress have been unabashed about what their prerogatives are in terms of pushing forward in those regards. So that's part of it. One has to look at the backdrop as well of previous events that have taken place in other countries. So you take, for example, the event in Dunblane, Scotland, back in 1995, and Port Arthur in Australia. These events are very questionable, and yet they were presented with the argument and the rationale that, well, now we have to rein in gun ownership. So I think that's one element of it. And another element of it is mental health mandates in terms of screenings and things of the like for, today it could be gun ownership. Tomorrow it could be going on to entering a courthouse or something of the like, you know. But I think that's something that is also part of a broader agenda, where there's a good deal of money as well from the pharmaceutical industry, and the sale, what have you, of antidepressants and atypical antipsychotics and these other sorts of designer psychotropics. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's something that is intended to be used as a conditioning sort of process for the broader population. And it in fact is. It's a rationale for various sorts of policies, school security, but the idea that this Adam Lanza, who was not a violent individual, nevertheless all of a sudden turned violent, right? So it was just this random violence that took place. And we see this in a number of scenarios that play out in the news on a pretty regular basis now, these events, these apparent shootings. But Sandy Hook is the one that is really overarching, I think, in many people's minds. Now, whether or not the event took place, it was something that, you know, as with 9/11, 9/11 is an event that, as far as I'm concerned, did take place. And that was taken advantage of to push certain types of agendas, total war against the people of the Middle East, and a police state at home. And you could say the same thing, I think, about Oklahoma City in terms of derailing the Patriot movement. And also setting the groundwork for the stealing the civil liberties that were further curtailed in the wake of 9/11. So I don't really think that we have a great cause to trust certain elements of the government in this regard, and that's why we really have to look at these events more critically. And study them and analyze them. That's not to say that we should, in a sort of knee-jerk response, come out every time that there's one of these events and say, oh, it was a hoax, it was staged, yada, yada, yada. But just look at them more critically, because the way I see it, there's an attempt here, an increasing attempt, and it's a lot easier now with television. It's not necessarily anything new. There's an attempt to mold our reality, to mold history, and to do this for the purposes of social control, taking away more and more of our freedoms and our liberties. And that's really very, very serious. 12 or 15 years ago, I think that most people would have been taken aback by seeing the extent to which today our police are so militarized. They're like the standing army that the founding fathers have warned us about, and yet here they are. And these things are incremental and they take place over a long period of time. But I think that it is these types of events along the way that provide the rationale for the state to increasingly encroach on our rights and our freedoms.
Can't argue with that. Remember the good old days in the 60s and 70s when talking about this stuff would be greeted with a round of applause and it would be cool that you're questioning authority? Now you're a pariah for doing it. What happened?
That's a very good question. I think that the very term now, the term conspiracy theory or conspiracy theorist, is used to denote a particular group. Because that's how Americans, for the most part, think politically anymore. They have to identify with a group, and they have to pigeonhole various groups. There's an excellent book by the Professor Lance DeHaven Smith, Conspiracy Theory in America, that actually just came out earlier. It came out in 2013, excuse me, and there's a very good discussion about this and how this is a set of terms that are used to really cordon off thought that that calls into question the dynamics, the inner workings of our secret government or elements of it. And so the term any more just needs to be invoked, and it tends to shut down conversation, right? Because people conjure up, not everyone, there are a significant portion of the population that conjures up something in their mind, some sort of estranged individual, on the verge of violence with these kind of weird thoughts about the government or black helicopters. There are all these stereotypes that are bound up in this. And so it's used to shut down inquiry. And it's very effective, I think. It's extremely effective for those of us. It's most effective for those of us that have the freedom to actually be able to question these things. So in that regard, it's really, if there was that degree of anticipation of its effect, then it was really ingenious in an evil kind of way, because the people that fear it most are academics and journalists, because they don't want to. Obviously they're alternative media journalists and so forth that have fairly thick skins, or this is, they're really kind of above the, or beyond the pack in that regard. But many, they really do run from that term, and so they won't even go places that are necessary to go for fear of invoking it or having it invoked against them somehow. And that's what happened to me, that type of treatment. So it's not an invitation to any sort of intelligent discussion, rather to kind of, preventing that and curbing it in some sort of way.
Are they still squelching you professionally?
You mean my employers?
Well, anyone, are they still making you feel like you have to be careful about what you would like to say?
Well, after the Navy Yard shooting back in September, I posted something on my blog, and it really wasn't even, it wasn't a commentary, it wasn't an essay, it was simply items from the press, some videos and things like that, the people had sent me that I thought were really quite intriguing. And I had not delved into the particular event in any great detail, but I just thought I'd post them because people do like to comment and the like. So I did that. I was on the following day, I think they went up like at 6 a.m. or something, and like at noontime, I was on one of the local newscasts. And I got some stock footage from interviewing me following the Boston Marathon bombing. And it was really amazing because I was in a public place. I was at the gym, and I was sitting there in front of on an exercise machine, and there I was on television. And it was rather unusual.
Putting your towel over your head, right?
I wasn't quite sure what to do yet.
Right.
I did. I made a couple of videos actually responding to that, and I contacted the station and I asked if they would like to partake in an interview with me. To discuss their editorial decision making, and I haven't heard back from them, and they've not reported on me at all since September. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not. And they wouldn't the news director wouldn't come on the phone or talk to me or return my calls. So it was picked up by a handful of national media as well, of Huffington Post and the Daily Caller, but that's about it. I think that having had the exposure in mainstream outlets, it certainly contributed to the growth of the followers of my blog, and perhaps that's something they would not like to see. I have no idea.
Interesting. What's your gut about this Sandy Hook event, Jim? Do you think that kids actually died there?
Well, that's an awfully difficult question. I think the immediate response for most anyone would be we would hate to think that our government would do something like that to create an event and to pull on our heartstrings to such a degree and for it to have not taken place. You'd hate to be, ruled or what have you by a government that would act like that. But then look at what's taken place over the past 50 or so years, and I wouldn't put it past them. And I don't think that the Obama administration is any improvement over the Bush or the Clinton administration. And we know what took place under their watch. So actually creating an event like this that did not take place, certainly not as fiendish of something perhaps as 9/11, but nevertheless, if it's still something that at least did not take place as we have been reported, then there should be people that will be held accountable for something like that, including the Attorney General and the Connecticut state government. I think that really, we know too little because there's not been a true investigation. And the people that I believe actually should be called forth and be sworn under oath and testify, including the people that are directly involved, the law enforcement and so forth, we don't know if that's ever going to happen. Because, as is the case with our financial industry, as is the case with the food that we eat and the drugs that we're told are safe, there's no accountability. We live under a tyranny. And so I don't think that's really any different here. But we're not really going to know the absolute truth until there is a special prosecutor and a grand jury that's set up in order to inquire further into the event. But my impression is that there's a lot to answer for. There are just so many idiosyncrasies, and so many problems with the official story, so many holes in the narrative, so many problems with the police report that's now been released. And just real contradictions. I mean, you got to wonder about the people that put this together and then put it out there for public consumption. The missing documents, I mean, one could go on and on and on, but it's something whereby people should be, in my view, held accountable. And the only way in which they have been, to a very limited degree in the court of public opinion, has been by independent researchers who've written about it, such as myself, and people who have produced videos calling things into question, And so I think those are good efforts, but that's not enough. And it could be in the future an even more catastrophic event where we are asked to forfeit more of our personal liberties, and we're not able to actually ascertain what took place until 5, 10, 20 years down the line. By then, it's too late. Look at how far we've gone since September of 2001. It's amazing. And there's still no real answers about what took place there. And even the individuals that you might think that would have enough courage to ask the questions, not everyone. I mean, there are those that have been on the forefront in that regard, but ones that really kind of have the a certain audience of opinion makers that are influential. I'm thinking of individuals like Noam Chomsky and, you know, the left. They've been particularly abysmal with things such as 9/11. But that's nothing new. It's been the same way back with the Kennedy assassination. You had public intellectuals like I.F. Stone and outlets like The Nation magazine that really just, they supported the Warren Commission, then they just dropped it. So I don't think that that's anything new. They've already dealt with the unspeakable, as Jim Douglas refers to it as being. And so why would Oklahoma City or 9/11 be any different? The problem with that is that with figures and outlets such as that, you have held captive in many ways. Again, a number of influential individuals that could create change and call for answers. And so in many ways, they're much worse than the actual perpetrators of some of these crimes and sort of public mystifications, if you will, this sort of altering of reality. And that's a real shame. And it's something that since I've delved more so into things such as 9/11, it's something that has been disillusioning in some ways to me, because a lot of my friends, some former friends, are very much on the left, or they perceive themselves as being, you know, socialist, Marxist, what have you. And it's been quite an experience, because they will, some of them look askance at me being in the news saying that, oh, well, Sandy Hook may have meant for gun control, or was for gun control. You know, what are you talking about? Are you a Tea Partier? You know, we've all got these political labels. And I've had to go through that with colleagues and personal friends. And in some cases, it's not been very nice. But at the same time, when you look at the broader picture, again, these individuals are of tremendous significance. Those that are the opinion makers on the left. The whole other matter that I think I was also called out by the progressive left, or liberal, what have you, blogosphere. In the wake of Sandy Hook, there are all these, you know, anti-conspiracists like Andrew Seitz-Bald at Salon.com, and the other individual who writes for the National Post, who wrote among the truthers. I'm blanking on his name now. But anyway, these folks come out, and they are rallying against me. And yet, it's in these left-leaning venues where you see all of this cheerleading about global warming or climate change, which it's the biggest hypocrisy in the world, right? They're talking about, for example, some of the commentators that maybe American Free Press and Global Research and some other venues about being, they're arguing that we're conspiracy theorists, and they're upholding one of the biggest frauds in human history, you know? Right. It's going to alter across the board all sorts of policies, and they're really advocating for that. So it's really, in many ways, very discouraging.
Well, let me just say that I've interviewed hundreds of people, and I have to ask the listeners, please, if any of you out there can find one thing wrong, just one, with what this man just said, let me know. Because I don't think that I heard one thing that I disagree with. And I think that somebody that knows as much as you do, obviously, and presents it the way that you do, and is as suspicious of government as you are, as everyone should be, that someone like you should be put up on a pedestal. This is the kind of hero that I grew up in the 1960s thinking about. Somebody who is questioning authority constantly, who does not trust government, who is level-headed enough to see all the sides and all the angles, and to be able to enunciate it, to be able to explain it the way that you did. This is the first time we've spoken tonight. Mm-hmm. And of course, you didn't know what I was going to say, and I didn't know what you were going to say, but I can say that after listening to you speak, I would love to see you in a much larger venue. And I think that somebody like you, Jim, is needed to a great degree in this country. But instead of people recognizing that, because what you're saying is absolutely true, the distrust for government, the absolute, unequivocated distrust for government is so important because they've done it before and they're going to do it again. But instead of people saying, you know what, this guy's right. There's nothing that he's saying that's wrong. What are they doing? They're attacking you. And I think that says, sadly, so much for the current state of affairs, the psychological state of affairs, in specifically the United States of America. I'm not even going to look at the rest of the world. That we went from a country, it seems, where it was cool to look at Woodward and Bernstein and say, wow, look at this. These two guys took down the president. That's awesome.
Yeah.
To now vilifying and mocking out somebody like you when they should be, like I said, honoring you.
Well, thank you. That's those awfully, awfully kind words. And perhaps this is an indicator of the extent to which we've, you know, gone down the path of the end or the real, I think perhaps it's on life support of critical thinking and discourse, the ability to be able to actually question things, because it's quite Orwellian to use kind of a hackneyed term, but if you're able to exercise the degree of social control just by using terms like conspiracy theorist, what have you, that's really, I think, in many ways what Orwell had in mind. Back when he wrote that book, the idea of being able to stop thought, to exercise doublethink, all of these things are in full play when we encounter events, these deep events that take place, and the majority of people will just say, "I don't want to go there because it suggests that it's just too dark." But if we don't go there, then what is really left for us? You know, when you think I've got children, for example, and so it's a major concern. What lies ahead? And if you've just got a majority of the population that says, "I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to deal with it. I will allow for major media to more or less do my thinking for me." And that sounds like an extreme statement, but that's more or less what takes place. For the majority of people, even the highly educated, in fact, I think in some ways they're more inclined to go with the flow of, say, what's on NPR or what's on the front page of the New York Times, rather than to actually question these types of things. And in their defense, they've got jobs and they've got responsibilities and whatnot. That's true too. And I think that's the biggest question that I bring up with we always arrive back at with students in my classes, and that is it the public's responsibility or is it the journalistic institution's responsibility to keep people apprised of what's going on? And I think that founding fathers were more than explicit about how the public is required to stay abreast of affairs of state, because if they don't, they're going to be ruled by tyrants. And that's just the bottom line. And there's a great deal of aid. There's a sort of a tide of more or less sentiment that is articulated by major media that really go against any sort of critical thinking. So that's in part what we are up against, which of course highlights the importance of alternative media, which are always there for the small percentage of individuals that really do care about events, about politics and so forth. But that's still a minority, unfortunately. And that's, one could look at the political landscape, and it's somewhat dismal as well, unless there are unless we can first of all actually recapture the ballot box so that our elections mean something, and outlaw electronic voting, go back to paper ballots. That's the first thing. But then you'd have to have additional political parties, I think, that actually do represent the people's interests, because neither of the two dominant ones do. They're essentially the same thing. So it's a rather large and ambitious project when you really, really consider that, and daunting, no doubt.
I think you're right about life support. Unfortunately, I think this is the end, and I don't know how it happened. I never would have imagined that it would have happened like this so quickly without a fight. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. Our biggest enemy is not the government. Our biggest enemy is our next door neighbor, because they don't know anything. And I think you were saying exactly what I just said. And the forefathers implored your average citizen to get educated, but they're watching television. They're watching Dancing with the Stars, or I don't even know if that's on. I haven't watched TV in so long, but whatever is on, they're watching that, and they're not reading, and they're not paying attention to stuff. And the example of what happened to you, a completely clear-headed, educated, cogent person such as yourself, raising a few questions about one event, was taken to task by the mainstream media as your average citizen cheered them on. And too few people obviously came to your defense. So sadly, I do agree with everything that you said. Like I said, I listened to every word that you said. I couldn't find anything in there that I disagreed with. Not that that should mean anything to anybody listening to this interview, but it means something to me. And I like to think that I'm level-headed and that I have a good grasp of the reality and what's going on around here. And I think I do, and I know you do. And I find it shocking, again, and I keep going back to this, but I find it shocking that so few people can relate to the things that you're saying, to the things that you think. Although everything that you're saying is based upon evidence. And I think it has to do with the fact that people just don't read anymore. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I think that's a big part of it. There's no doubt about that, and it's not just a matter of reading, because there's a percentage of the population that are involved in reading the New Yorker or the Wall Street Journal, and it's not a big part of the population, but a percentage anyways. But I think that major media has to be tempered with alternative perspectives and. and I think a critical take on what is being articulated. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that Americans as well, particularly younger individuals that I come in contact with, do not have a historical awareness or consciousness. They don't know their country's own history, and they don't know the history of their, you know, their government. These sorts of things that were once taught in civics class. You know, civics class became, I think, government and then social studies and, you know, further and further down. But at one time, a citizen actually had to know how their government operated. And that might sound a bit hokey, but it's true. And that's the basis of it. And without that, people are increasingly divorced from civic life, from what's actually going on. And so they'll pretty much go more or less any way that their what's the term that Silverstein, or rather Sunstein, uses? They're nudged, right? Sure. Right. That. God. Is that sort of that creeping authoritarianism, right? We're not going to, you know, it's just something that you might hear out of Edward Bernays if you were alive today. We're going to nudge the population, right? Essentially what his idea was. But yeah, people don't have any bearings. And I'm not saying that everyone, obviously, but a significant portion of them, and especially younger people. And so if they don't have any bearings, then how can they know where they're going? Even in their personal lives, and how can they know where they're going and what they would like to see as far as a society to live in, a nation? There's no way they can. That's been something that's been, I think it's been removed from the public school curriculum intentionally. That's a whole other matter that we could talk about. But students, young people, don't see themselves really as political beings. They don't see themselves as historical beings. And I think those two are really intertwined. They see themselves as consumers or something along those lines, and they're more concerned about achieving a particular type of lifestyle, and that's why they want a college degree. It's not to become a liberally educated individual. It's more so because they've been told that that will somehow open the gates to a particular livelihood and whatnot. And maybe it will, but it's one element of it. One element of a larger sort of list of things that make up a complete and whole individual. So, it's something that begins, I think, at home, but it is something that is nurtured or quelled in the school system. You know, the majority of our young people in this country go to public schools. Now, of course, there's the Common Core, you know. You can't teach them anything unless some bureaucrat in Washington approves of it. It's just crazy. But that's what is taking place, unfortunately. And I don't think it bodes well for the future.
Now, what's your gut? Is there any hope for the country coming back to what it once was?
Well, I'd like to think that there is. I hope that is the case. There are, you know, certain, I think, causes for optimism. I may be closer to some of those things than others because they're kind of involved in what I do for a living. The group that I'm involved with, for example, Project Censored, and every year they put together, you know, the top stories that have not been covered by major media, and discuss those things among other types of related issues and concerns, those things keep me optimistic, and perhaps if I don't if I keep from looking at a broader purview of the challenges and the obstacles, then I can remain a bit more optimistic. I hope that's not really putting my head in the sand. In some cases, it can be overwhelming when you really think about it. And you look at the broader types of agendas and institutions involved in bringing those agendas to fruition. That's kind of frightening. And to get back to the earlier part of our conversation, I think some of these events that we see on an increasingly regular basis in the news media are an element of this, of something larger. And that's unfortunate. But again, you could point to various things that on the horizon or even closer that are really big challenges. And for every one of those things, I could mention to you various, journalists, commentators, activists that are alive and that are bringing this to the attention of increasingly broader publics. And that's encouraging. And I think that's another way, perhaps, of addressing that question in a way that's not a complete downer.
Well, I would have preferred just a simple yes or no, but
okay.
Well, like, so, I'll give you mine. No, I don't think there's any hope.
Okay.
I think because of what happened to you, it really illustrates it. How many people actually came to your defense?
Well, you mean writing publicly or in that sort of fashion, or who knocked on my door and said, "Hey, I'm sorry to see your situation in the media," or
yeah, both.
Oh, not as many as I would have liked. I went to a conference this past fall, and I ran into a number of people, and everyone was quite cordial. These are people I've known from since graduate school, many of them, and some of them said, they just said, we would have attempted to contact you, but we figured that the deluge, you were probably just getting all sorts of emails and calls, and one thing led to another. But they were somewhat supportive. But I don't think that anyone really came out, not many came out in full force, as far as colleagues went, to weigh in on my side. Not as many, again, as I would have liked, but there were individuals in the, alternative media that were quite supportive, and that contacted me and invited me on and to discuss what was taking place and my perspective on the whole Sandy Hook event. So that's something else. I think that even with the Patriot media, however one wishes to refer to it as, I think that there's also a tendency to handle the Sandy Hook and Boston events in a way that is sort of at arm's length. And I'm not exactly sure why that is. I just figure there's so much baggage there with these events being so very controversial in many ways that they've not taken them on probably as fully as they are capable of doing. And I think that that's an interesting phenomenon. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but I hearken back to the example of the way in which the left, liberal left, the establishment following the JFK assassination, no one resigned, no one left their post, there was no public outcry. The person 3 years later that actually did go about investigating the JFK assassination was proven right years later, of course. Garrison was similarly denigrated in major media. There was a campaign that was waged by the CIA through various media to help, torpedo his case. And perhaps things would have been different if David Ferry had lived, but that case was sabotaged. So it's not necessarily anything new. I think what I was getting at in part with regard to the left and so forth following the JFK assassination is that they generally did not seek to take it on. That was also the case, with Malcolm X, and much more so with MLK and RFK. These sorts of things just were really not taken on to the extent that they could be in terms of actually being interrogated and questioned. And I see something similar taking place with Sandy Hook and Boston. That is just, okay, we're kind of players here to some degree. Now, if we actually say that these events were contrived, that they were drills or partially drills, then of course, we're going to be called into question too. So look at what happened to James Tracy. We don't want that to happen. We've got maybe an alternative media enterprise that is contingent upon satisfying a certain portion of our listenership or viewership or, readership, whatever. And there's also the gun rights lobby, and they are players as far as lobbying goes and legislatively in D.C. This is just too outrageous of a theory, of a hypothesis, that Sandy Hook was, staged, or that Boston was similarly a drill, or at least a portion of it was. We can't go there,
You're right about that. I think you summed it up about why a lot of these alternative outlets are afraid to talk about this. Certainly, I'm not afraid to discuss it, as you could see.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why anybody would be. But then again, it gets back to the public where, I won't even listen to that. How could they talk about that? Geez, the guy doesn't think kids were killed. He has some doubts. Well, okay, so who cares? So we have doubts.
Yeah.
What do you want to do, burn us at the stake? We have doubts. Yeah, and they would want to burn us at the stake. I'm sure they would. Some of them would. It's amazing how you can't even talk about something like this. Like I said, I've interviewed a lot of people. I must say, I've never interviewed anybody quite like you with such a solid grasp, as far as I'm concerned, on the way things really work, the reality of the world we live in, the reality of the United States, the reality of the government. And it was it's a little cliche, but it really was a distinct honor and privilege speaking with you tonight, listening to you speak, and I hope that we can do this again in the future.
Well, thanks very much, Dave. Thanks for the opportunity. I've greatly enjoyed the conversation as well.